Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets podcast. I'm John Heumann. I'm the editor. We're here today with Stephen Wilmot, Companies Editor.
Hello, John.
Theron Mohammed.
Hello, John.
And Mark Robinson over in the control room. How are you doing, Mark?
Oh, very well, John. And yourself?
Yeah, not so good.
There we have it.
As you well know. So, yeah, busy week on the markets. Lots of interesting stories. I'll tell you what, let's kick off with Sky, Theron, because that is quite an extraordinary story. The amount it's paid for Premier League football. In fact, Sky and BT have paid between them for Premier League broadcasting rights for the next 3 years. Sky paying the lion's share. So it strikes me as an enormous amount of money, £11 million a match. And, you know, I've watched some games this season and I don't think many of them are worth £11 million. Can it be justified? Can that level of expenditure by Sky be justified? I mean, it's insane. It seems insane.
Well, I think going into the auction, it was a must-win fixture for Sky.
Yep.
Because Sky Sports is such an integral part of its offering.
Mm.
And essentially, BT has sort of been stealing ground from Sky. It got the Champions League rights from this year.
No, I'm not too bothered about those. I support West Ham, so Champions League fixtures are not that important to me.
Essentially, Sky had to keep its current proportion of the rights, otherwise it risks subscribers decamping to BT almost immediately. Mm. And BT Sport is actually free to its broadband subscribers.
Indeed, I must admit, I'm a BT broadband subscriber and I have BT Sport and I hardly ever watch it, despite the fact that there's football on it. But maybe that says more about me than anything else. I think we describe it in the magazine as a Pyrrhic victory. So it's got what it wanted, but it's had to pay through the nose for him. Can it actually justify, in terms of potential returns it can expect from them, that price? Because we've got this on a buy, haven't we? I mean, we like Sky.
Yeah, I think we still do like Sky.
And right.
There are a couple sort of saving graces. So it's moving into mobile next year. And once you're getting your mobile, fixed line, broadband and TV all from Sky, it makes it incredibly difficult to switch to another provider.
Well, I remember the old adage is, you know, content is king. And, you know, Sky certainly has the content. I mean, I must admit, I don't watch a lot of football, but I used to watch a lot.
Well, you watch West Ham.
Yeah, which is... shut up. I used to watch a lot of golf, and you know, Sky over the years has kind of pretty much captured everything. I used to watch Formula One. You know, now Sky has half of that. Used to be on the BBC and ITV for a bit. They've just won the Open. They've just won the rights to host the Open, or to host the broadcasting of the Open from 2017, I think that is. So, you know, there's not a lot of sport left on the BBC for free to air. So, you know, it could be, in my mind, a good move for Sky to consolidate. You know, if you're a sports fan, you have to buy Sky. Basically, that's what it seems to me. However, there's other, you know, let's broaden this out. Yeah, in the telecom space, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at a lot of big mergers. You know, is it all about content now, or you know, is it something else? There's other stuff afoot.
Yeah. So the main trend is this quad play thing, as I suggested: broadband, fixed line, mobile, and TV. And the idea is that if you're subscribing to all four from one person, your churn rate is going to be lower, so fewer people are going to leave. And you can charge them more because you can spread the cost across four packages, so it doesn't look like you're getting charged as much as you really are.
Yeah, yeah.
And presumably it would keep administrative costs down, you know, per subscriber if you've got...
Synergies. Are we talking about synergies?
Yes, synergies.
Synergies.
Well, but actually Theron was... we were discussing at the news meeting this morning that actually the evidence from other markets may be that quad play isn't...
All cracked up to be, yeah. well, that's an upcoming story, but... I think, well, in Spain, it's a very developed quad play market, and Telefónica there has actually found that it hasn't had the advantages it expected it to. But it's yet to be seen if that'll be the case for Sky, because Sky's been able to attract huge amounts of subscribers with its triple play packages without and raise costs at the same time.
So Sky is very very expensive, Sky. I mean, you know, I don't buy it. You know, I buy my broadband, and I have a separate mobile contract with... Three, which is buying
O2.
Yeah.
I also use Three, and I'm worried they're going to raise it. I use the £15 a month all you can eat data, which is pretty unbeatable.
But then BT's buying EE, is that right?
Yep.
BT's buying EE, so I'm thinking, well, I have a BT broadband package now. You know, this could be good news because now I can buy it all off BT, get my mobile off them as well, and 4G. I think EE's 4G network is probably a bit ahead of threes.
It's the number one in the UK.
So very exciting.
Yeah,
yeah. A lot of competition, I would imagine, and I would imagine, you know, you talk about raising prices. I would imagine there's going to be some pretty cutthroat pricing competition in the years ahead in that respect.
Well, it's interesting you say that because some people are obviously complaining that the moves reduce the number of players in the market.
Yeah, so I just don't believe that. That's...
But at the same time, they're all starting to compete with each other. So yeah, because of the telecoms and media sectors kind of converging, you've actually got more competition, even though you've got sort of fewer players. So it must be a policy nightmare because the regulators probably struggle to take the bigger picture.
Regulators struggling with a bigger picture. My goodness, who would have thought it? I also pay £6 a month now, I think, for Netflix, which actually I think comes with the BT package already. So I think I'm paying too much anyway. But you don't buy Netflix. You bought something else, didn't you, Stephen? Which we talked about a little while ago.
I used to purchase Netflix and then concluded I wasn't getting.
But you bought something else. What was the?
I subscribed to a curated picture house film package from Mubi, which I don't use as much as I thought I might, so I might actually have to can that as well.
But does it have House of Cards? That's the question.
It doesn't.
Well, I must admit the Netflix productions are amazing, and I was about to say content isn't perhaps king, but I think content is king. I'm happy to pay £6 a month to Netflix, and we started watching Better Call Saul this week, which. It looks all right. Mm-hmm. It's not breaking bad. It took a while. It took a while to warm up. But there you go. Okay, so Stephen, what else? Yeah, companies have started to pick up their reporting this week. What's going
on? Yes, well, we had some of the big pharma names, obviously. Glaxo, Smith & Nephew, AstraZeneca, all reported this, all in this week's magazine. So if you're hoping for a recovery there, then this week's magazine is a must read.
Astra, I must admit, I noticed Astra's results were pretty lackluster.
Yes, and so were GSK's.
But Astra is particularly worrying given the
share
defense line that it put up against the Pfizer bid, which is that, no, we're great. We're good. We don't need Pfizer.
I think
rubbish results.
Yeah, I think that's the main problem. It took such a bullish management line last year that it really struggled to come up with numbers that justified the bullish tone, really. So, you know, that we have them on a hold because they do look a bit overpriced given the fact that they only, even with this bullish tone, they only expect to return to growth in 2017. So.
Acquisition premium, perhaps? Because I know Smith & Nephew, the artificial joints company and wound care company, also reported this week, and again, pretty lackluster.
Yeah, not
the shares
bad.
Are trading quite expensively.
Yes, I mean, I guess people expect M&A to be a theme again this year. I mean, the US GDP is picking up. You'd expect that to feed into animal spirits from American chief executives. The no one, Pfizer actually announced its own big bid, another big bid last week, so we don't expect it to come back for Astra. Smith & Nephew has long been seen as a target for Stryker, a Michigan-based rival, and there were, particularly before Christmas, there were rumours that it was planning an imminent bid, lots of newspaper stories, nothing's actually come of that, but yes, the premium results. It's hard to know what to do in these situations because, you know, one doesn't want to buy shares in a company after it's got had a bid or rumours of a bid because of the risk that the rumours dissipate and then suddenly the shares collapse 10 or 20%.
Well, the old rule of thumb is, you know, buy on the rumour, sell on the deal. So, you know, if you think a company is going to get bid for...
Yeah, I suppose depending on how early you are.
So you have to be pretty early on in the game.
We had actually an interesting bid story this week with Wrexham.
The
largest, the biggest riser in our risers and fallers, it'll... column here on page 7.
Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, up 22% because it was bid for by a US corporation. So this does seem to this story that animal spirits in the US and of course a strong dollar makes bidding for UK companies much more attractive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe UK companies can start looking over to Europe because the sterling euro rate is incredible. 1.35 to a pound. Mm. It's amazing.
Yeah. If only I weren't going to Norway next week.
Yeah, well, you know. Anyway, to Lilyhammer. Talking of Netflix.
So, but with the Wrexham. So, I don't know if some readers might not be familiar with Wrexham because it's not a company we write about all that much and not much. Happens
we,
direct well
we do,
whatever
right,
no
we
write about
it at least twice a year at least as twice, we will discuss
at least
it in
twice a year yes but it makes the cans that you sell Coca-Cola and other soft drinks in
and lager
yeah absolutely so it's you know it's not in a great business in that it's quite exposed to aluminium prices and it had a profit warning last November as a result. We actually had it on a tip, and we moved to hold back in November. As
it was a buy. It was a successful. It was a pretty good tip. Actually,
it was a pretty good tip. I mean, it's actually it churns out cash year after year.
Yep.
Just not with very high margins and sort of this unpredictability you get from making a low value product with having to buy in commodity prices, but commodities. But anyway, it's got a bid and. You know, but we wouldn't say buy now because it's up 22%, and mm-hmm. The chance that you know you've only got 8% upside to get to the bid price, I think it's 8%, which doesn't seem like the risk that the bid goes away and they fall back 20% seems somewhat bigger than than the risk than the upside you could get from kind of getting taken out. So but if you had followed our tip last year and was still in Wrexham and was still holding Wrexham, then it was a good week.
Indeed, wonderful. Listen to the Investors Chronicle. Results wise, Theron, let's come back to you because there was another result this week which you wrote, which was Arm Holdings, which looked pretty good. I mean, you know, we've always felt perhaps that Arm is one of those stocks that always looks super expensive, but it keeps delivering, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it keeps delivering.
It's so difficult to justify buying it when it's almost 40 times forward earnings. It makes imagination look cheap.
Yeah, it offers 31 times earnings.
But there's no company like it in terms. When I spoke to the finance director, he's saying they have over 90% share of the Internet of Things market already, and they have 90% share in smartphones and dominant shares in tablets and. All these consumer electronics.
So we talk about this Internet of Things quite a lot. Or you talk about this Internet. So what is it? I mean, you know, what are we talking about here?
So in the home, it'd be connected fridges, so your fridge could see when you run out of stuff and send an order to Ocado to fill it up.
Yep, sounds brilliant.
Your car will be connected to the Internet, so if you have an accident, the authorities will be notified.
Really? My car broke down on Monday.
Could drive itself, of course.
My car broke down on Monday. And I spent 2 hours sitting by the side of a road in the middle of nowhere in the middle of Essex. So, the Internet of Things would have helped a great deal had my car not been 11 years old.
But he also talks about things like light bulb efficiency for street lamps and that kind of thing. I mean, I think he mentioned that on the Today programme yesterday.
So it goes beyond the connected
home, and I mean, obviously, there's a sexy retail angle here, but it's a very, very, you know, widespread.
Google bought Nest, the heating. Domestic heating company, thermostats and smoke alarm. But yeah, so basically, what we're saying is the world is becoming more interconnected, and you know, rather than now it being you looking stuff up on your iPhone, it's extending beyond that, so that devices have a little bit of intelligence that are doing things that save you doing them, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the predominant example this year is going to be the Apple Watch, which was sort of heralded. Possibly the rise of wearables in the mainstream.
Haven't Samsung. They've already launched watches, mm-hmm. haven't they?
Yeah, but I get none of the analysts are particularly convinced. They think this is something that Apple can again come to the market late and
because with its brand, it can actually
and retail
base, of course, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But with Arm, I mean, to go back to Arm, it's I guess the issue is that it's. So much the dominant technology play in the UK that all fund managers who want to have exposure to that sector for portfolio balancing purposes will have this company, and therefore it's always going to be expensive. And why should private investors bother just for the sake of kind of portfolio balance with. But at the same time, it always it continues to be traded. You know, it.
But then look at their share price.
I mean, yeah, it's true.
You know, I think Bearville has written about ARM before, and he's written about it in the same context as Apple, and he's described it as a dream stock. Okay, and
it was one of his world's best companies, wasn't it?
It was. He's a bit fickle. But no, when you talk about, I mean, Apple, you know, talk about, yeah, it's a dream stock. The valuation is ridiculous. The valuation of Apple is
not
ridiculous.
It's not that bad at all.
but you know, can it keep delivering? You know, ARM, I guess, falls it. Can it keep delivering? Is it really that good that it can just keep churning out the returns, the profits in the way that it doesn't? You know, well, you've got to look at that market share. Intel's tried to muscle in and failed. Intel has failed against ARM. It's an extraordinary company, really.
Well, what's interesting this year is that basically with ARM, they get licensing revenue and then that flows into royalty revenues once the microchips start being made and put into products a few years down the line. So the success of the Apple iPhone 6 is going to be a great tailwind for them this year. So there are a few factors in their favor.
So we're not even seeing that yet, no. I guess, in ARM's results.
No, that's not there at all.
And I guess this is what people are paying for. This is why the shares are expensive too, because we know that the future... it's going to be pretty good.
Recurring revenue streams, yeah.
Yeah,
and one of the concerns was the slowdown in the premium smartphone market, and Apple's shown there's plenty of growth still there.
If you're Apple.
If you're Apple.
Not necessarily if you're Samsung. Amazing. Actually, Apple's one of the companies, you wrote a little bit for me this week for the cover feature as well, which I think is interesting, because not only is this a company that's delivering enormous... So the cover feature this week, before I go on... is about where we find income in a world that, you know, in which interest rates are trending towards virtually nothing and not likely to rise for some time, and growth is becoming increasingly hard to come by. So we looked at some companies and some funds that we thought were, you know, good bets for such an environment. And Apple is one of the companies we looked at because it's starting to pay dividends too. It's got a lot of cash.
So I think in 2012 it started paying quite a small dividend. At the moment, you wouldn't buy it for the dividend, you buy it for the cheap stock and the potential of the company, the huge dominance.
Isn't it? What is it trading on now?
I think it was
11, 12?
Without cash, about 12, I think.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. And yeah, you mentioned Wrexham earlier, churning out cash. And these are the kind of businesses we're kind of interested in. You know, if you're an income investor, look at those businesses with excess cash, which are house builders. Has been a great example.
House builders is an interesting, you know, like Apple, you wouldn't think it would be a company. It's not a company that's historically been associated with cash returns, but for, you know, it's different from Apple and the pressures that are, you know, because it met, basically the house builders messed up so badly in the financial crisis, they're desperate to prove to shareholders that they're that they have cash discipline, and so they're giving it all back. And Persimmon, I think, was the company that Jonas chose to for the income feature. And the forward yield is, you know, pretty impressive. I wouldn't want to quote a figure. Somewhere around 6%, Jonas says.
This is including special dividends.
Including specials.
Yeah.
Persimmon plans to return the equivalent of 620p a share over 8 years, giving an annual yield of somewhere around 6%. I mean, and it's credible given the dynamics of the business. So.
Indeed. So, Mark, you were a little bit more brave in your pick for the income shares. You went for Shell, and you know, given what's going on in the oil and gas sector, that's a pretty bold call, Robbo.
Well, it's based fundamentally on their cash position, their ability to generate free cash flow. I mean, I think last year it was something in the region of 25 billion. That was based on some sales revenue, obviously, and we're unlikely to see that level again this year. Obviously, they're not hiving off as many assets as they have in the past. But we think, compared to the other majors in that space, it can sustain that dividend. And let's face it, they haven't sort of marked that back since 1945. It's a record that they're adamant about maintaining.
Mm.
So, Ben Van Beurden said this week, who was explicit in the fact that this is almost sort of sacrosanct with the company's concerned.
They're not going to do a tallow, Ben.
No, they're not going to do a tallow. Tallow's got its own problems as well. Actually, I meant to.
So tallow reported this week and it canned its dividend.
Yeah, it had to take an impairment sort of around about $2.5 billion.
Wow.
That had been sort of foreshadowed in January, but they've got some operating problems as well, and they're looking now. They seem to be focusing almost entirely on their TEN project in Ghana, which will increase their output from in West Africa to about 100,000 barrels a day. That's about a 1/3 increase from the current level.
It's worth pointing out here, isn't it, Mark, that Rio Tinto reported results today and increased its dividend. Now, of course, the miners have gone through 2-3 years of cutting back their capex.
Well,
and the fruit is now being seen, and that they have the free cash flow to support dividend increases. Now, Shell, you know, just to get back to that income story, you'd think that. Okay, it's going to take some time, but cutbacks that they're making to CapEx now should eventually feed into...
They're feeling some benefits already, but this year is going to be a little bit difficult for them, I mean, unless we get the recovery in oil prices. The point with them is they've got fairly low debt, something like 14% at the moment. They're highly cash generative.
Gearing is 14%.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry.
Let's be specific.
Okay. And so relative to the other players in the sector, they're certainly well positioned to maintain that. I took a look at Rio today, as you mentioned, and bearing in mind that iron ore prices have more or less halved since this time last year, an underlying sort of 9% decline in underlying earnings is a pretty good result for them. It missed the Citi consensus. But on top of their cash flows, they're able to sort of increase that dividend by 12%, and they've also announced a $2 billion share buyback, and they've cut their their net debt by a third. So that was a pretty good performance by Rio. Part of this is down to the scale benefits that they're accruing now. They actually managed to increase their seaborne shipments by a fifth in 1 year, which is extraordinary, really.
It is considering what's going on in China, which we've also covered.
Well, yeah, about 38% of their revenues are generated in the People's Republic, but they're a low-cost producer, Rio, and so I think unless China reverts to an agrarian economy overnight, I think they're in a pretty good shape for the future. I mean, they're going to experience difficulties, obviously, across a range of commodities, which the outlook is generally negative.
So, are they taking share then? Are they taking market share then from higher cost producers?
Well, exactly, and a lot of high cost producers in Australia have actually pulled out of the market. You know, smaller companies, obviously.
Yeah.
So, we've sort of been fairly consistent in this. We could see the benefits since. Sam Walsh came in the beginning of 2013. His twin.
Are you blowing your own trumpet here?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, the collective we. Sam Walsh came in the beginning of 2013, and he was explicit in his intention to reform the balance sheet because, under Tom Albanese, the company had been, well, profligate, I guess, any way you could describe it. And so you can see the benefits coming through now as well. And the twin approach as well was expanding their operations in the Pilbara to generate scale benefits, and they're coming through also. So, I mean, while they're faced with the same problems as everyone else within the sector, they're sort of better placed to see it through.
Well, I mean, the thing that worries me about mine, you know, I can see these arguments, and I can see the argument that the oil and gas sector is getting itself into a similar. Shape in terms of its capital discipline, but sentiment is not going to get any better. And we've got a piece this week that Graham wrote. Graham's not here today, unfortunately. On China, and China's looking a bit ropey.
Yeah, well, exactly. They're talking about 7% growth through this year, and
it seems to be falling all the time. Every time I look at it, the growth expectation seems to be pared back a little bit more.
Well, actually, you know, Graham's piece was resolutely downbeat, but. I guess it's a relative factor. You mentioned a few weeks back that China could not maintain that level of growth.
Yeah, but he's talking about. I mean, there's a figure here, and he's talking about a composite index of factors, including things like rail freight volumes and electricity consumption. You know, they suggest if you put them together that the economy is actually growing at almost half the rate that its headline figures suggest it is. I mean, that's quite a big difference.
Well, that's right. I mean, the rate there is given as 3.9%. which is quite worrying. But I mean, these are sort of standard measures. But I would just like to know the way that they're compiled. This is this is compiled by Thomson Reuters and Fathom Consulting.
They're pretty reliable. I mean, Thomson Reuters. I mean, we use their data.
I mean, it's just a different way of.
Fathom is the contrarian among economic.
Yeah, we like contrarians. our own economist is a contrarian. You know, I mean, Chris Dillo is not your average economist. It's the way we like to do things. So, I mean, I like to pay attention to contrarians.
Absolutely.
Because at least they, you know, at the very least, they point in the direction of things that you may want to consider as a risk.
Not have thought of, yeah.
Indeed. But, you know, so anyway, I mean, it's a worry. I mean, Mark, we spoke, maybe last week, before your dad. Over in Oz had, you know, witnessed himself a slowdown in
shipping. Looking wistfully out to sea, just the number of coal tankers that sailing out from Newcastle Harbour have dropped appreciably, according to.
We bring you the global news here at the Investors Chronicle podcast.
I mean, we did mention last week as well that the Chinese authorities had cut the reserve ratio for the banks as well, and that's a pretty clear signal that they're trying to stop on the one part outflows from the economy, and also trying to increase lending.
Yeah,
so, I don't know.
I mean, the other point Graham makes, and I think it's a very very pertinent one, is the currency strength as well, which, you know, may be hampering its competitiveness.
Well, yeah,
it's pegged to the dollar. It's you know, dollar's been strong, and we know that elsewhere in the world currencies are tanking against the dollar. There are potential, you know, policy decisions that can be made in China to perhaps stimulate the economy.
But they don't really want to, because this is all part of their plan, right? They want to rebalance it.
Plans are there to be changed.
Adjusted. Yeah.
And adjusted. Indeed. So I guess, anyway, you know, Chinese statistics, we don't really know what is actually happening there anyway. So, you know, 3.9%, 7.8%, who the hell knows? But at least we know about what our companies listed in the UK are up to, don't we, Stephen? Don't we?
Well, absolutely. Or do we? Well, exactly. And you bring up a pertinent point, which you're obviously making reference to your editorial, your leader here. Yeah, we had some engagement from a concerned reader this week who was worried that the abolition of the quarterly reporting requirement, which is part of the
disappeared last year.
Yeah, indeed.
The whole timetable for its abolishment was accelerated.
Was accelerated, yeah.
Very quickly and quietly, it has to be said.
So companies no longer have to report quarterly. No longer have to give IMSs.
Indeed, so you would know these as the interim management statements, generally speaking, and most companies, in fact all companies, would have provided them, some in more depth than others.
But now they no longer need to, and this reader was very concerned that a particular holding of his, you know, he'd have to wait for four months maybe before he got any update on trading, and he would be concerned that, you know, things would have been going to pot while... effectively, he had nothing. He knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
And of course, the question then is: does anyone else know anything about it? And I suppose the concern for a retail investor is that they'd be having, you know, fund managers would be having one-on-one briefings with the management, you know, being given a something of a steer out the door, while, you know, private investors would be left holding on to.
That would be illegal, stock. Would it not?
Well, no. When they're not in closed period, they can. Well, this is the point.
Price-sensitive information has to be disclosed to the market.
Price-sensitive information. And that's obviously what the previous regulation of disclosure has been based on, this idea that anything needs to be disclosed, and therefore you have quarterly updates so that there's less of a risk that...
Price-sensitive information seeps out.
Yeah, exactly.
To some people and not everyone else.
So, yeah, I mean, there is a concern there. At the same time, the rationale for abolishing IMSs, I think, was a very valid one, which was to encourage long-term investing.
Which was made by John Kay.
Which was made by John Kay in the Equity Market Review of, maybe, was it 2012?
Christ, that was a long time ago. After
the financial crisis, you know, they were worried that people had become too short-termist in their thinking, and they and one of his recommend, and it was a beautifully written and very interesting.
John Kay is a wonderful writer.
Exactly,
he's a very intelligent man.
It was a wonderfully written sort of analysis of the problems with the UK stock market, but it was criticised at the time for being short on conclusive recommendations, which says something about his background in academia and journalism, I suppose.
So we don't disagree with the principle,
but
one of them was we at the IC believe in long termism.
Right, absolutely, and there is a reason why we don't cover IMSs apart from through brokers' views sometimes and tip updates.
So we commit to cover. Let's restate this as we often do. We commit to cover every interim result, every half year, and every full year of FTSE 350 companies.
Exactly, because the worst thing you can do for your portfolio is to act on every 3 months.
And IMSs historically have not provided anywhere near the same level of financial detail that the half year.
Yeah, as the CFA Society pointed out, they're broadly three types of quarterly statement. There's the US style quarterly earnings, which very few companies do.
Basically,
it's companies which have significant US investor bases. So some technology companies. GSK and Astra,
Unilever,
pharma companies, the really big or global companies or ones which are in a sort of sector which is dominated by the US, like pharma or tech. And then there are those that give quite a lot of information but don't actually give you an earnings number.
No numbers,
which is most companies.
Yeah,
and then there are the smaller ones which say next to nothing apart from everything's going fine and P.S. We wish we didn't have to do this. sort of the subtext and so the CFA Society, I think logically enough points out that those companies will probably stop doing this, but the rest will probably continue in the way that they have been.
Well, that's quite interesting because we companies also tend to report pre-close as well, so they'll give you a little update as they go into their close period as they prepare to release their financial results.
Which, as you pointed out, we
struggled to find out whether that was actually a legal obligation.
And
I don't think it is.
No.
We couldn't work it out.
No, there doesn't seem to be any obligation.
No.
So,
but they do it anyway. And this was the point that we were making, was that actually, whilst the obligation to release quarterly financial statements or quarterly reports is gone, companies do, generally speaking, want to be transparent with their shareholders and will continue to communicate with them as effectively as they can.
And the CFA worries that companies might have more volatile share prices if they stop giving updates.
Because they're worried about unscheduled updates, because...
Exactly.
Which will happen anyway.
This consultation statement says companies that do stop giving interim updates run the risk of increased share price volatility and a higher cost of capital.
Well, I would agree with that.
Which might be true, but then if that's the case, and surely these highly paid management teams can spot that's the case and then just give an update. It's only no one's banning them from making updates. It's just the obligation to make updates that's been removed.
Well, indeed, the point I think the CFA Society made very well in their CFA Society of the UK. Who gave us their publication of the year award very recently, I hasten to add. The point they made very well, I think, is that is the difference in the information you get as a private investor as you would if you were an institutional investor. And I think, they refer to the nudges and winks of the management on a roadshow type thing. What is it? Can you dig it up if you can? I think that's a very pertinent point. I once sat on that side of the equation, and it's true. It does, whilst they're not necessarily revealing inside information, how they feel, management, when you're sitting there as a fund manager, sitting there as a broker, watching the communication between a company and a fund manager. Yeah, and that worries me. But what I would say is I would hope that companies actually use this to their advantage, because now they have 4.5 months of the year in which they are not obliged to say anything to the stock market. But perhaps we can improve the way companies report to their private shareholders, their retail shareholders. Perhaps a capital markets day for retail shareholders is what some of these companies should be doing anyway. The obligation to report four times a year and sometimes with limited value, you know, how much value is that really adding to your, you know, your investment knowledge? I'm not sure it is. As I say in my editorial, I would urge private investors to basically, you know, if you're worried you're not getting information from the companies that you invest in, petition them, because you know, they do tend to listen. They do tend to listen. And in fact, Philip Ryland has written an interesting feature this week on corporate transparency, based on a report by an organisation called Transparency International. And actually, when I look down the list, and it's a global list, UK companies are very transparent relative to their international peers. I think we have a good market. And I think we should recognise that. I think that, yeah, companies are generally pretty good, mostly. So, okay. So thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Theron. And thank you, Mark. As I said, lots been going on this week, and there's lots in the magazine. More than we can do justice to in a half an hour podcast. Actually, it's a bit more than that, sorry. So thank you for listening. Go out and buy the magazine. Plenty more in it. As usual, there's plenty in the funds and personal finance section, which we rarely get to discuss on this podcast. And actually, what we are going to be doing in the very near future is launching a dedicated funds and personal finance podcast. So we'll keep you posted, but that should be good too. Some really good stuff there. The reader portfolios in particular are incredibly popular. And this week, we actually revisit a guy whose portfolio we reviewed a few years back, and he's a 39-year-old with far too much money, and it's sickening. There you go.
Of course, there's also Woodford's new fund this week.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Lots to read about.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. So, yeah, anyway, £4.50, all good news agents and supermarkets, of course. So go pick that up, and we'll catch up with you again next week. Thank you very much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.